Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of this show. I am Bob Van Buren, your host. Hope you've all had a great evening so far. Welcome. We have a lot of newcomers here, new subscribers. So just kind of give you a little rundown what the show's about. Each week, I have an individual guest that comes on, talks about a hobby, a profession, special interest. Might have some music coming up. So it's pretty much anything, you know, hence the word variety. So that's what I'll do each week is just, you know, you never know what you're going to have. It's always going to be an interesting guest. And so I think you're really going to enjoy it. I also want to take the time to open it up. Always looking for a person with, you know, an interesting profession, a hobby, talent. Maybe they've written a book. Maybe they can do arts and crafts, or maybe they're kind of in some kind of adventurous hobby. Would love to talk to them. So if you are like that, or if you know someone like that, please contact me. There is my email address on the screen right there. It's vbvarieties@gmail.com. That's V as in Van, B as in Buren, varieties@gmail.com. So if you know someone, promote their business, whatever they'd like to do, whatever they want to talk about or entertain, please just send, I'll point to the right direction, email that right there, and I will see how we can schedule them on. Would love to have you, love to have them there. Tonight, we have a very, very interesting and serious topic as well, but I want to sort of put you, the person watching this, in this situation. Okay, this, imagine this, if you will. It's World War II. It's the early 40s. Most of Western Europe, if not all of Western Europe, has been occupied by Adolf Hitler's enemies. You're flying a mission over occupied Europe, an American, and your plane gets shot down. You are now in occupied territory. Just consider that for a minute. What would you do? Now, remember, you're in a country that maybe used to be friendly, but is now occupied by enemy territory or enemy soldiers, such as these here. Okay. You land, but who do you trust? The natives are there, but how do you know the natives are really on your side or will really help you? To put this in context, I have downloaded a map of Europe during World War II. So let me bring that map up. That way you'll know exactly where we're talking about here at this time. Again, this is Europe as it looked in World War II. If you look there, you see Germany. But if you look to your left of Germany, or you would say west of Germany, you'll see the country of Belgium. They've kind of initialized it, B-E-L-G. Belgium was occupied at that point by Adolf Hitler's army. So was France, so was Luxembourg, and so was the Netherlands. All those countries right there were under enemy occupation. Just a picture now being shot down over one of those countries. Who do you trust? You're in enemy territory, maybe alone. Your crew is also shot down. What, if anything, could you think of to do to survive? Your family back home has no idea whether you're alive or dead. That would be a very, very stressful situation. I think you would all agree. Well, that actually happened. This is based on a true story of a gentleman that was in World War II and was shot down over enemy territory. And his son has written a book called Shot Down. And he will talk about that tonight and give us more insight to his, I mean, hero, such a weak word to describe his father. His father was an amazing man from what I've read and what I've heard. So he can tell you more than I can. So let me bring my guest on now. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Steve Snyder. He's written a book about his father, his very stressful time in Europe when he was shot down. So, Mr. Snyder, welcome to the Van Buren Variety Show.
Well, thanks, Bob. I'm glad to be on.
So let's just kind of take it from here. Tell us how your father is military service and how he kind of came to be where he was.
Okay. Well, as a result of the first peacetime draft in history implemented by President Roosevelt in the fall of 1940, my dad went into the service in April of 1941. Mm-hmm. And he went into the Army, the infantry, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. 3 months later, he married my mother, Ruth Hempel. And then that December, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was at war. Well, my mom was really scared at the time. The future was very uncertain. So she went up to visit my dad in Washington over Christmas. And she got pregnant. So my dad is a little concerned how he's going to support his new family as a new bride, a baby on the way. And he didn't think he could do that very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force, where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in June of 1942, he entered the Army Air Corps. I went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana, California, and then went through the various stages of pilot training, where he finally graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 1943, where he received his commission as a second lieutenant at his pilot wings. And then from there, he went to transitional training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. Then went to operational crew training down in Texas, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And when they were deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. And on October 21st of 1943, my dad and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group based at Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London. And from there, they started flying bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany.
Wow. Very interesting. You mentioned this crew. Is this the crew right here in this picture?
Yeah. B-17 had a 10-man crew. The four officers were kneeling in front. My dad is the lower left. He was the first pilot and as such the commander of the plane and the crew. And then going across, you have the co-pilot, the navigator, and the bombardier. And then standing behind the four officers are six enlisted men or non-commissioned officers who were mainly gunners. Five of those men came home, but five of them did not.
Oh, wow.
That's not the Susan Ruth they're standing in. That's just a B-17 that they took their crew picture in front of when they arrived in England.
Okay. And let's get here's another good picture of your dad I'd like to share with the audience. And was that right? Was that still he was still in England here?
Well, that actually is after he came back home.
He came home. Okay.
Yeah. And he was promoted to a captain at that time. So after his trials of missing in action and everything that he went through after being shot down, then this was when he came back home and had that picture. Things were a little happier.
I can tell you, he's smiling really big, so yeah. He has a right to. That's a handsome guy. So kind of take us into kind of that day when he was doing a mission over, I guess, occupied Belgium and what happened there.
Okay. It was on February 8th of 1944, missioned Frankfurt, Germany. On my dad's plane, they dropped their bombs successfully, but the bomb bay doors got hit by flak. And a aircraft fire, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, they started losing, because the drag in the plane, they started losing airspeed, and they fell behind the bomber formation heading back to England to their bases. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, 190s. And like wolves or lions on prey, they swooped in. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the 10 crew members were killed in the plane. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. But both those German fighters were shot down too. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed and he died in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and he survived the war. And my dad, after he bailed out, he came down right at the French-Belgian border. And he came down into some trees and his parachute got hung up on the branches and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Devan, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. This occurred early in the afternoon and after they helped him down out of the trees, they told him to stay put and hide because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight with German patrols combing the area. So that night they came back and got him, and they took him to the Dervan farmhouse. He only stayed there one night because they thought, again, it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols in the area. So the next night, a Belgium customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle, brought one of his spare custom officer's uniforms that my dad put on. And then they headed out to go to a safer location. And I'll tell you one little story about that trip.
Please, dad, I'd love to hear it.
my dad had some shrapnel wounds in his left leg. So he could only pedal with his right leg, his good leg. And they came to a hill, and they weren't able to pedal up it anymore because it was too steep. So they got off the bike and started pushing it up the hill. And when they got up to the top of the hill, there was a cafe there, a cabaret. And the lights were on, loud music was playing, people were talking loudly, laughing. And all of a sudden, two German officers come walking out with these two young girls. And one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks for a light for a cigarette.
Oh, man.
Well, my dad's, you know, he's flabbergasted, you know, probably pretty
nervous. Well, I'd be scared to death, yeah.
Because, you know, he couldn't speak German or he couldn't speak French at that time. But fortunately, Paul, you know, knew what they wanted, and he took out a match and lit the guy's cigarette. My dad said these guys, you know, were drunk and talkative and wanted to talk. Paul said they needed to go on their way.
Yeah.
So they went on their way. My dad said they were the two German officers were too drunk, or schnockered, as he put it, and too interested in these young girls to pay much attention to a couple, you know, customs officers pushing a bike up in the middle of the night.
Wow. Well, that was, whew, that's pretty stressful.
Yeah. And that building is still there. All this occurred, like I said, right at the French-Belgium border. In southern Belgium is all rural farmland. So nothing's really changed. All these locations where the events took place in the book are all still there. So you can go there and visit where history was made.
That would be interesting. See, I love history. I love seeing old sites and old buildings. And I think those need to be preserved for the future generation so that, you know, that they'll remember. Here's an interesting tidbit. You mentioned, now I know, but my audience doesn't know. The B-17 that your dad was flying was called the Susan Ruth. And so if people aren't familiar, you want to know, well, why was it called the Susan Ruth? So you tell us, why was the B-17 named Susan Ruth?
Okay, well, that baby that they had after their rendezvous in Washington was Susan Ruth Snyder. So she was 1 year old at the time he went overseas. So they named the plane after my oldest sister.
His own daughter's name that was named.
Of the 10-man crew, only three of them, the crew, were married. And my dad was the only crew member that had a child at that time.
I thought that was interesting. He named it after his daughter.
Right.
Very interesting. okay, like I said, we got a live audience watching. We got one little question here. Let's see if you can answer this one. Randy says, where is Steve from?
Okay. Well, like my mother, I was born in Pasadena, California. And we both went to UCLA, actually. My mother was a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson. When I was at UCLA, I was a classmate of Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, wow.
But now I live in Seal Beach, California, which is a little quiet beach town in Orange County, south of LA, about 40 miles.
Okay. I mean, is it really sunny California? I've never been to California, but I keep hearing about sunny California. Is it for the most part?
Yeah, it's a funny point. When I was growing up, they always talked about the weather, and I could never understand what they were meant about the weather because it's always the same here, you know. But in 1985, I started traveling all around the United States on my job, and I learned real quick what they meant about the weather. You know, going back east and the snow and the freezing, and then, you know, during the summer, the heat and the humidity. So I finally found out when I got older what they meant about the weather, because it's so mild here.
Oh, well, let's talk about an interesting book, ladies and gentlemen. If you are a history buff like me, you will want to buy this book. I have not read it yet, but I've read the preface, and just talking to Steve here, interesting. So let me bring this up for the audience. The entire book is called Shot Down. It's the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. Now, I do want to correct something on this picture. At the very top, you'll see it says winner of 13 National Book Awards, but that's actually old information now. Steve, how many awards has it won now?
I think it's pushing 30.
30. Oh, yes. Wow.
It's done pretty well. Well, it's an amazing story, and it's just not about my dad, but the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of my dad's crew, and also about all the Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them escape from the Germans and hide from the Germans. The first half of the book kind of builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards.
And I think that's what I'm intrigued by your book, Steve, because, I mean, if it was just only about your dad, I would still be wanting to read it. But you've gotten different point of views. It's about different people that was there.
Right. Exactly.
And
something happened. Different happened to each guy. And like I said, five of the crew came home, but five of them did not. So there's triumph and tragedy in the book.
And I'd also like to point out to the audience, not only did Steve write his stories of his dad and the crew members there, here's a very unique part of the book. He also has an interview with this man in the book. So, Steve, will you let us tell us who this man is?
That's Luftwaffe pilot Hans Berger, who shot down my dad's plane. All my dad knew and all the Air Force knew at the time was that my dad's plane was shot down by two German Focke-Wulf fighters. And that's all I thought I'd ever know. But one day when I was doing my research, my wife just casually said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I'm thinking to myself, oh, she's so naive. You know, she doesn't know what she's talking about. It's a ridiculous idea. It'll be impossible. You know, more than likely, whoever shot him down was killed during the war. Sure. It's 70 years later, you know, they're passed away by now. I can't speak German. Yeah. But like a good husband, I did what my wife told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war and speaks perfect English.
Wow.
And when I found him, I discovered that the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans down at the same time that he shot down my dad's plane. So they shot each
both
other.
Both ways. Here's the picture, ladies and gentlemen. Here's the picture of Steve with Hans Berger, with this man who it was in his 90s at the time. So, I mean, and you got his perspective as well, Steve, in your book, correct?
Yeah, he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. Hans was shot down three times. But survived the war. He's wearing his fighter jacket there. You probably can't see it, but he has his Iron Cross pinned to it. He shot down seven B-17s and one Spitfire. And he said it was unfortunate they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war.
That was war. Our countries were at war.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's amazing, Steve, because that shows, you know, that you can shake hands with someone who was once, quote, the enemy. I mean, I think it shows forgiveness. I think it shows the human spirit that we can move on. And, you know, again, everybody, I mean, your dad was serving the United States and Hans was serving Germany. I mean, so again, it's war. And, to talk to him, in other words, you're getting another point of view in your book. I think that's intriguing. That's very nice. And, you know, and I'm seeing another picture that you took of him. He's holding your book right there. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
See that? That's his apartment in Munich, Germany, where he lives.
He still lives in Germany.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
And we've become good friends. You know, after all, he was pretty much just like the U.S. Airmen. He was 19, 20 years old, you know, trying to do a job, fighting for his country and trying to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in time, my dad's path crossed Hans' path. And so Hans is part of my dad's life, part of his story. And so I felt kind of a kinship to Hans. I didn't really have any hard feelings about it. If my dad had been killed, maybe I'd feel differently. I don't know, but we become friends. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. For the book, I just interviewed him over the telephone and through the email. But I've been to Germany twice since I wrote the book to visit Hans and spend time with him.
I think we have another question from the audience here. Let's see if I can bring that up. This one comes from Gary. He's right. Only five made it out alive. Did the Germans catch the other three trying to get out?
Well, five of them came home. Actually, eight of the 10 crewmen bailed out successfully.
Okay.
Two of the crew were killed in the plane. And then of the eight men that bailed out, three were captured immediately and became prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. Two of them were so severely injured that they were repatriated back to the U.S. before the war ended.
Okay.
The third man, the flight engineer, Roy Hobart, that was captured, he spent the remainder of the war as a POW involved in the Black March, the 86-day Black March. My dad and another crewman evaded capture, although they weren't together at all and had totally different experiences evading. And then three other crewmen, they evaded capture for a couple months. They actually joined up with five other downed airmen from three other B-17s. And they were hiding in a makeshift hut in the woods outside of Chimay, Belgium. But a Belgium collaborator ratted them out to the Germans, and the Germans came and captured him, took him into the Chimay schoolhouse, interrogated him, then brought him back out in the woods and shot all eight of them.
Oh, man. Oh, that's horrible. Wow.
Yeah.
And I like to put that into context. Yeah, you told your story at the beginning, but for my audience here, anyone who watches this, Steve said his father was shot on the Belgian-France border. But in order to put that into context, both France and Belgium were both occupied by Germany. So it was technically enemy territory on either side. I'm wondering just how did your dad know? I mean, I guess you have to trust somebody. Because, you know, unfortunately, with every occupied country, you get collaborators that collaborate with the enemy. So I'm sure it was probably difficult to trust people right at first because you don't know which side they're on. Correct? Did he ever say anything about that? Excuse me.
Well, yeah, they're, you know, in these occupied countries, you have all sorts of different types of people. But, you know, the first 3 years of the war, you know, Germany was winning the war. And so a lot of people in these occupied countries figured that, well, Germany's, you know, they're going to win. And so we want to be on the side of the winners.
That's true. Yeah.
And then you have other people that are just selfish and out for themselves. And so, you know, they were just greedy people. And so they were collaborators because, you know, airmen were shot down. The Nazis put a bounty on their head. So if you were a Frenchman or a Belgian and you turned over and ratted out a downed airman, you know, you get paid a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. But it was really stressful for my dad. You know, first of all, you know, his plane's attacked by fighters. It's on fire. He has to bail out. He comes down to a foreign country, has no idea where he is. Doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military. And as you mentioned, he's being helped by total strangers. They can't really communicate because he can't speak French at the beginning and they can't speak English. He has a little French-English dictionary in his escape kit that he could refer to. And any one of these people could be a collaborator and turn him over to the Germans. And while he was in hiding, he was missing in action for 7 months.
He was
in hiding. He had several close calls of being discovered by the Gestapo that are described in the book, which were pretty harrowing.
I'm sure. Wow. And speaking of stressful, you had told me something before. Interesting note. You just said that your dad was missing for 7 months there. So while he's missing for 7 months, what's going on at the home front with his wife, your mom? What's happening there about this time?
Well, when my dad left, my mother was pregnant again. So while my dad was missing in action, my other sister was born.
While he was missing,
whether he had a boy or girl until he came back home. But that, you know, here's my mom back in Pasadena, California, with a 1-year-old, you know, girl and an infant baby girl, not knowing if she'd ever see her husband. One thing that makes the book real personal is that there's lots of excerpts from letters by members of the crew, family.
Oh, really?
That make it really poignant, especially the letters that are exchanged and excerpts from those letters after the crew was shot down, and the fear that wives and mothers and sweethearts felt and expressed to each other in letters after they found out that the crew was missing in action and didn't know if, you know, who was alive, who was going to make it. That was really moving excerpts from those letters.
So when he was shot down, was he in Belgium the whole time, or did he go to France, or just kind of take us from there?
Well, after Paul Tilkan picked him up on the tandem bicycle, he was there. After that, he was moved from place to place to place in Belgium.
Oh, wow.
How long he stayed at any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night at one location or 6 weeks at another location.
On the move, yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the move. He went by car, bicycle, walking, railroad, all different forms of transportation. But the people who hit my dad, or any down nearman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked their lives, not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends. Because of the German secret police, the Gestapo found out about it, they'd be arrested, tortured, and either sent to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people that helped my dad and other members of the crew met that fate.
That's sad. But now he did go to France, and then he joined. Was this the French Resistance, what I'm seeing here?
Yeah, finally my dad got tired of hiding. Now, word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on June 6th, D-Day, and he decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, my dad had that year's experience and training in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. So he decided to join the French Resistance, much to the chagrin of his helpers, Belgium helpers, because they, you know, it was much too dangerous. You know,
absolutely.
Fighting, or if he was captured by the Germans at that point, he'd be shot as a terrorist. The safest thing, or the smartest thing maybe for him to do, was just to stay hunkered down and in hiding and wait for the U.S. armies to come up after D-Day and liberate the area. But he thought it was his duty to, you know, get back in the fight. That, you know, there were Americans out there fighting and dying, and he felt it was his duty. So one of his helpers, Amy Cools, they got on bicycles and they rode across the border from Belgium into France. And my dad met up with a unit of the French Resistance. They were called the Mackie.
Mm-hmm. And they these people here.
Okay. Yeah, that wasn't the group that my dad joined, but that gives you an idea of what they look like.
Sure.
They were small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France. And they harassed the Germans. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, assassinate German officers, attack German convoys. And they got their instructions from the British through coded messages over the BBC. Mm-hmm. My dad said if the British said there'd be a convoy coming down this road at this time on this day, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing that everything that the Germans were up to. And then they were also supplied by the Germans through airdrops. And again, in the book, there's several encounters described that the resistance group had with the Germans, which are pretty exciting.
It sounds interesting. I'm intrigued.
So my dad fought with the French resistance for a little over 2 months. And then finally on 7 months after he bailed out on September 2nd of 1944, word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Treslong, France. So my dad went into town and the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which would come up through France after D-Day.
Oh, wow.
And he identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. And then he caught a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris. And then in Paris, he hopped on a transport and made it back to England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mom saying, "Fit as a fiddle, honey. Bank the money," because he had all that back pay.
Oh, I bet she was so relieved.
I can't imagine what that day was like for my my mother and my dad's parents and, you know, other relatives. Yeah, it was a glorious day for sure.
Okay. How about this here? Let's see. I'll pull up some of the pictures. Is this your them here?
Yeah, that's my dad. He has his A2, you know, bomber jacket on there. I don't know whatever happened to that. He didn't come home with it. But those are two of his helpers.
He had two of his helpers there. Okay.
Yeah, in Belgium, he had many, many people that helped him. And the ones he stayed with lengthy periods of time with, he kept in touch with after the war. We exchanged Christmas cards, and he stayed in contact and till they died.
Oh, wow. And, you know, I like to kind of reiterate kind of what you said earlier. Like, for example, these two women, for example, I mean, they risked everything. Because if, you know, again, if the Gestapo had found out that they were hiding an American pilot of all things, I mean, they would have, it had been over as well. So, I mean, they were heroes as well. So I appreciate their efforts.
Yeah, Paul Tilcan, the customs officer, a couple of months after he helped my dad, he was arrested by the...
Him?
Not
them. Okay.
He was arrested by the Gestapo, sent to prison, tortured, and he narrowly escaped being executed. But his health was broken from the torture that he took, and he died at not too long after the war. Mm-hmm. Now the gentleman you just showed...
Let me put that back up. Yes,
That's Dr. Paul Delahaye, and I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for Paul and another Belgian gentleman, Jacques Lalot, who were young boys during the war and greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed against their family and friends. Mm-hmm. And later on in life, they interviewed all these Belgian people, members of the Belgium underground, about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So a lot of their research is in the book. Then in 1984, Dr. Delahaye formed the Belgium American Foundation to honor and remember the U.S. troops and allied troops that came to their rescue to liberate Belgium from 4 years of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they erected a number of memorials in the area, one to my dad and his crew. So my dad and Paul were very good friends. And now Paul died in 2013. But his daughters, Crystal and Savrine, carry on his legacy. And I'm dear friends with them. But I was a good friend of Paul, too. I met him on several occasions.
That's really good. Now, you mentioned memorials just now. That kind of brings me up to my next question, next segment. There is actually a memorial, what we call a Susan Ruth in the B-17 Memorial. I'll bring that up. So is that located close to where the crash site is, or where is this at located?
Yeah, that's in the little village of Mackinaws at the distillery farm, which is very near where the plane came down.
Okay.
You know, there's no one in the plane. Well, the two crewmen that were killed, but they, as the plane came down and swirled down, they were kind of thrown out of the plane, but it's near where the plane crashed down. And on the front there, you see two plaques that have the names of the crew, their ages at the time and their crew positions on the time. That memorial was erected in 1989. And prior to 1989, my dad didn't, like most World War II veterans, didn't talk very much about the war. I just kind of knew the basics. But my dad and three other members of the crew that were still living at the time went over for the dedication of the memorial. And there my dad was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war and revisited these homes.
What a great reunion.
And that brought it all back. And then he started talking about it. And then I made my first trip to Belgium in 1994, 5 years later, with my parents. And that's when it became personal for me. So because I got to see all these places firsthand, going around with my dad, and actually were able to meet a couple of his helpers.
Wow, that's great. I mean, some people, war is so horrible, they don't like to talk about it. But I'm glad that your dad was able to talk about it. And again, I'm a history buff, so I think it's very important that we hear these stories, and not just for their generation, your generation, my generation, but for generations to come. Because it's living history is what I would call it.
Oh, absolutely. The story of my dad and his crew is all based on firsthand testimony by the people who were involved in the events. I retired in 2009, and that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And 3 years into my research, at the beginning, I had no intention of writing a book whatsoever. But after 3 years of research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of him and his crew was so compelling and so unique that it needed to be told. So I wrote a book.
And I'm looking forward to reading it myself. I mean, I'm just intrigued just talking to you and hearing who you've interviewed. Let's talk about the B-17, the plane itself that he was flying that day. Is this one here?
Yeah, that's part of the 306 bomb group. You can see the triangle H on the tail there. The 306 bomb group was in the first Air Division, mm-hmm. which was signified by a triangle. And then every bomb group at the peak, there were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force. But the 306 bomb group designated letter was an H. So the triangle H of the 306 bomb group. And then that H plane was assigned a specific tail number by the manufacturer, and that's the tail number of my dad's plane, 31499. The Boeing company designed the B-17 and produced 60% of them, but Lockheed Vega and the Douglas Aircraft Company each produced 18% as well. There were three different models of B-17s flown in Europe. The first was the E model, which they only built about 500 of those, so they were quickly phased out by the F model. And then the F model was phased out in the fall of 1943 by really the definitive B-17 model, the G model, which you can always tell the G model by the chin turret underneath the nose. So that those B-17s that you showed flying are the F models without the chin turrets, but my dad was shot down in a G model.
I see. We have a comment from here, more of a comment than a question. I think it's very, very, that's very nice. Gene Hudson says, you hear of things that happened in school and when family talks about it, but these stories really bring it home, what men sacrificed for all of us to have our freedoms. Amazing. Thank you, Gene. I think that's very nice.
Absolutely. They were the greatest generation. And flying combat was just brutal. And extremely dangerous. 26,000 men died in the 8th Air Force, which was more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. And another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky, either by German fighters or German anti-aircraft fire. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed.
Well, on your dad, do you know, did he always have, or did he say that he always had aspirations to be a pilot, or did he just become interested once he joined the military? How that kind of turned about?
The only reason he became, went to the Air Force is to make more money to support his family.
Okay. Hey, that's a good reason right there.
Yeah. And it was a good decision,
The That's great.
After the war was over, he didn't fly again, as far as, his own plane, because, he didn't want to stay in the military because he had a wife and two little girls. He wanted to get back to civilian life and, start a life with his family.
Sure.
Because, when he left, Susan was only one and Nancy wasn't even born yet. So he really didn't know his daughters at all. So he just wanted to get on with his life.
Well, I'm certainly glad he did. He deserved it, actually,
Yeah.
after all he had been through.
But at the time the World War II started, there weren't that many pilots. Almost all these guys that flew during the war, they were just civilians, and then they went into the Air Force and learned how to fly a plane, whether in the Europe or in the Pacific. So there was just a very, very small number of guys that knew how to fly a plane before World War II started, because commercial flight was not prominent at all. Airlines or air flight was still in its infancy,
Yeah,
prior
sure.
to World War II.
It was kind of a new concept, actually, for sure. Let me bring this kind of into context too. And as far as geography, you said that he was shot down over the Belgium French border, which was, they're both occupied, of course. But now in the history shows that when France was occupied, there was the north, which is the German occupied France, and then there was the lower section, which was Vichy France.
Right.
For our audience, now I know, but for our audience, was it the northern German occupied, or was it Vichy France where he was?
Now, it was the German occupied the part of France to begin with was northwest, and then Vichy was southeast. But eventually, the Germans took over all of France. In a couple of years. I forget exactly the date that they took over Vichy France as well, but no, it was occupied by the Germans.
Let's see. We talked about memorials too. And there's a photo I want to share with my audience. I think this is one of my favorites that you sent me, is this one here. And you can kind of tell what this is right here.
Oh, that's the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. My dad wanted that picture was taken in 2004. My dad wanted to go see it before he died, so I accompanied him to a reunion of the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society, which was held in Pennsylvania. And then we took a bus down to D.C. to visit the memorial. It was right before its official dedication. This was April of 2004. The official dedication was in May of that year. But that was the last trip he ever took. My dad died 3 years later in 2007. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but is the oldest at 91.
91 years old. Oh,
Yeah.
wow.
So that was a great trip. Like I say, the last one he ever took. It was I cherish that memory.
I bet he enjoyed that little memorial. Let me ask you, I've never seen that memorial. As I see it behind you, it says Atlantic. Is it different parts? There's another one that says Pacific. I've never seen the memorial myself.
Yeah, on the other end of it says the Pacific. So that one end of it is kind of dedicated to the Atlantic theater, European theater, and then the other side is dedicated to the Pacific theater.
And each one of the little walls, I see the ones that land, there's little bitty walls. Does those represent something? Is there something engraved on them,
I should know that, but I
or
forget. I don't know if it's the 50 states.
could be. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
That might be. I should know that, but I don't remember.
Well, I'm glad your dad got to see that monument. I'm sure that he enjoyed that.
Yeah, he was a great dad. We had a wonderful relationship.
Was there ever a time that when he was telling these stories? I mean, let me ask you this question. Was he pretty much open as far as back as you remember about his war stories, or did he have to wait a little while before he kind of kind of opened up to talk about it more. How do you relate that?
Well, after the dedication of the Susan Ruth Memorial in 1989, you know, he was very open. I wish I would have asked him more questions than I did.
Yeah.
Because I know the facts and, you know, what happened. But now you always think about these when it's too late. I would have wish I had asked him about, you know,
yeah,
how he felt and, you know, what was going through his mind. Yeah, I knew what he did, but I didn't know how he never really knew how he felt about it. Although, you know, he was forever grateful for those Belgian people who hit him. He owed them his life. And they would let him sleep in their bed. They'd sleep on the floor.
Oh, wow.
They would give him, you know, whatever food they had, depending on where he was. Sometimes he'd eat pretty good. Other times he'd just be eating, you know, potatoes or bread made with sawdust. But they would always give him, you know, more food. And so he couldn't thank those Belgian people enough. And he went back, actually, I think, three or four times to Belgium. I've been to Belgium now 6 times.
Oh, wow. Well, and, you're well-traveled now.
And I can't wait to go back again. Every time I go back to Belgium, I find something new about the shot down story.
Really?
It's amazing. Yeah. Like the last time I went back, we found out that my dad's tail gunner, Bill Schlenker, he came down in France. And initially he was hidden by this French woman on her little farm.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was injured. So the French resistance brought him over the border into Belgium to the Chimay medical clinic. They smuggled him in the back door of the clinic, actually, because it was controlled by the Germans. And the doctor, you know, fixed his leg. But the great granddaughter
great-granddaughter
who hid Schlenker, she contacted the American Air Museum in England trying to find Bill Schlenker because her grandmother told her about him. Mm-hmm. And then they knew of me, so they put me in contact with her. And on our last trip over in 2019, I met her and Bill Schlenker's grandson. We came over as part of the entourage. And she took us down to that farmhouse in France, which she owns now, this little stone building. And we went in and, you know, we went down in the basement where she hid Bill.
It's still there.
Still there. You know, it's, things like that happen every time I go over. I went over one time and this friend of mine said, I know a guy that has pieces of your dad's plane. Like, you're kidding me.
Wow.
He goes, yeah. After the war, this Belgian man, you know, took a couple pieces of the aluminum, made a roof for his chicken coop. And then this guy who collects militaria at his home, you know, we went over to his place. This guy couldn't speak any English.
Mm-hmm.
But you should have seen this guy's collection in his home. He could have started his own museum. He had, you know, all these guns and helmets and, you know, oh, it was amazing. But he had a small little piece of my dad's plane and then two larger pieces. One was nailed to the ceiling of his attic. But he gave me the small piece and then the bigger piece I couldn't bring home. But there's a little museum over there in the area that has memorabilia about the war and about the Susan Ruth. So I dedicated it to that. So something... Every time I go over there, something new surfaces. It's incredible.
Keep going back, Steve. Keep going back. We want to know more.
It's like, you know, that Chimay schoolhouse that the Germans were occupied as a barracks, basically, that they took the airmen back to and interrogated them. In one of the schoolrooms in the classroom, there's German writing on the wall. That's still there from World War II. It's just amazing the history that's still there.
I'm very, very intrigued. You mentioned the hiding earlier, talking about your dad when he was hiding in Belgium, by some very, very brave individuals there. You said they let him sleep in their bed, but were there ever times, did he ever say that maybe, I don't know, were German, maybe Germans were maybe nearby and they had to either throw him in the basement or hide him in the closet somewhere? I mean, did that ever occur?
Oh, yeah. This one time he was at Maurice and Ghislaine's Bayou house in Charleroi, Belgium, which was a little further north than Chimay. But there's pounding on the door one night. And Maurice told my dad to get up on the roof.
On the roof?
Oh. Yeah, and then he'd come get him when it was safe. Well, he never came. My dad spent the entire night up on the roof because the Germans never left the area. And I've been in that house and in the attic, and there's just this little small window that's in the attic that you have to crawl out of to get up on the roof. Mm-hmm. And the roof has this real steep pitch, and it's made of tile. I can't imagine climbing out of that little tiny hole and getting up on that roof, let alone staying up there all night long. Incredible. But that's I've been in all these rooms, these houses, these farms where my dad stayed, look out the window, look out this little porthole, look up on the roof where he hid. So it's absolutely amazing to be so blessed to be able to go back and see all this, where everything took place.
Everything happened. And not only just see where it happened, Steve, but you're talking to the family members or the future generation of these people. And I think that just adds to the story right there.
Yeah. Also at the Bayou house there, the last time we went, we were taking some pictures out front, and then the second story window opens, and then this man looks out and says, "Can I help you?" He could speak English pretty well. I said, "Yeah, my dad was hidden in this house during World War II. He goes, "Really?" So he comes down. And then Maurice Bayou had taken a lot of pictures. And that, in fact, there's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything.
Oh, wow. I'd love to see that.
But Maurice had taken a bunch of pictures while my dad was there. And there was I showed him pictures of in the back of the house where they were sitting around. And so he took us around and showed us that area. Looks just like it did, 75 years ago.
Nothing changed.
And then I showed him a picture of my dad inside the house. And he looks at it and he goes, "That wall covering behind your dad is still there today." So we go inside the house and the wall covering is the same wall covering that was there 75 years ago. So I posed my dad posed against this wall covering. We took a picture, so I have one with my dad here in 1944 and one with me there in 2018.
75 years later.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think that's important. It sounds like the Belgian people, for the most part, they preserve their history. They really believe in their history.
They're unbelievably brave, wonderful people. To this day, they're still so thankful and so grateful for the Americans rescuing them from Nazi occupation. And they do a great job of educating the younger generation to remember and realize the importance of it. In America, we have no concept of what it was like to be occupied by an enemy force for 4 years, where every freedom that you had was taken away. And you suffered, this brutal occupation, people getting murdered for nothing, killed over nothing, thrown in prison for nothing. You can't move around freely. Food is scarce. You're going hungry all the time.
In a constant state of fear all the time.
State of fear. People in the U.S. just can't comprehend that. We've never been invaded. We've always had our freedoms. We can do whatever we please. And that's the sad thing, that a lot of people today, especially the younger generations, lack the appreciations for what it took and the sacrifices that were made for us to enjoy the freedom that we have today. But those people in the occupied countries, I mean, they know what it's like that lose your freedom. Sure. So they, you know, try to really impress upon their children the importance of what took place.
Absolutely. Well, Steve, it's not all lost because we have people like you that keeps the history alive. And that is very much appreciated, not just you know for your dad's sake and his crew's sake, but for everybody. I think every American needs to appreciate and knows the sacrifices because they weren't easy. And so I'd like to bring up your book again for the people that are watching this, whether you're live or watching on the archives. If you love history, and you have to buy this book. It's called Shot Down. It's a true story of Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. Just to kind of reiterate, it was shot down over occupied territory in World War II. And it's a story of survival, of bravery. I'm sure, like he said, we haven't covered everything in the show, but I mean, harrowing escapes and really, really a stressful time. But it sounds so interesting. And he's written it not just from his dad's point of view, but from the crew members and even at the time an enemy soldier from his point of view. So, Steve, let me ask you this. If somebody watching this wants to buy this book, what would you say the best way to do that? How would they order this book from you?
Well, most people get the book on Amazon, but if anyone wants a signed autographed copy, they can go to my website, stevesnyderauthor.com. That's S-N-Y-D-E-R.
Okay.
And then I'll sign it. You can just pay by any credit card or debit card, and I'll send it to you. And my website is just not about my book, but there's a great deal of history about on there about World War II, archival footage of the air war, interviews with veterans. There's just a lot of information about World War II and about the air war over Europe. Also, in addition to the story of my dad and his crew and the Belgian people in my book, what I added was just a great deal of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it in context and give it background. So it's a history really about the entire air war over Europe, what was happening in the world at the time, the 8th Air Force, the B-17, what it was like to fly combat missions. So in addition to the story, the riveting story of my dad and his crew, it's there's also all this history that I've added to it.
Sounds very, very, very intriguing. And ladies and gentlemen, I got the website here below you. It's stevesnyderauthor.com. So check it out for more information. And of course, if you buy it from here, Mr. Snyder here can autograph it for you. So that's well worth it as well. So, Mr. Snyder, I can't tell you how great it's been to have you on this show. You're gonna just curious. Do you plan on writing more books? Hint, 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 hint.
No, I don't think so. I get asked that quite a bit.
Our loss.
Really, since I wrote the book, it's changed my life. I basically have a part-time job now because I go all around the United States signing copies of my book at air shows, and I do lots of public speaking, making PowerPoint presentations about
That's
the book.
Good.
And so really it's become a new career for me, but it's my passion. You know, it's what I love to do. And I just try to keep the memory of these guys alive.
Well, I've always heard if you do what you love, it's really not a job. And so that's it sounds right. Like you're doing what you love, and that's actually wonderful. Again, ladies and gentlemen, go to stevesnyderauthor.com, and the book is called Shot Down. Very intriguing book. I can't wait to get my copy. So, well, Steve, I am very grateful you came tonight. It was great been talking to you more about you and your book and your dad. So I appreciate you sharing your time with us tonight.
Well, thanks, Bob. I appreciate you inviting me on your show. It's been a lot of fun and very enjoyable. So, much appreciated.
Okay. Please keep in touch.
Will do. Okay.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Take care.
And ladies and gentlemen, I think that's all it's going to be all the time we have for tonight's episode. Appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much for tuning into the Van Buren Variety Show. And if you really like it and you want to see more guests and more topics, you got to hit that subscribe button. And then that way you can keep track of upcoming events. And don't forget, you can look back on the archives and see past episodes that we've had. So I think you'll be very, very impressed with that as well. So ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad you tuned in and hope you tune in again. We are here each week with an individual guest, a different topic. So look forward to seeing you once again. This is Bob Van Buren for the Van Buren Variety Show. Have a great evening, everybody. Good night.